Good morning, everyone. I'll reconvene the hearings. This is hearing stream six dealing with the residential zones. The hearing panel for this set of hearings comprises yourself, the chair, Commissioner Munro on my right, the urban designer from Montana, from Auckland, and Commissioner Gazzard on my left, who is now a ratepayer, as he tells me.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. Good to hear again. We have filed written legal submissions, and I understand that you have a copy of those before in front of you. Also filed on Friday were copies of evidence summaries for each of the four expert witnesses and one each for the authors of the Section 42A report. Attached, you would notice that those evidence summaries are more than two pages of length. I take full responsibility for that.
I accept that because of the circumstances of the two matters.
Yes, and I thank you for the minutes that you have issued and received this morning. Those submitted all the legal documents I brought in today. One of the other reasons why those evidence summaries are slightly longer is the planners have endeavoured to respond to the evidence that has been filed to assist the panel in terms of being transparent as to what their position is before the hearing starts.
Could just before this matter, mate, can I just raise a matter with you, Ms. Scott? There's two matters actually. Yes, I can hear it quite well, but I'm not sure because I was only just hearing you. Is that him?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. The first matter is I understand that the council has had a recent council meeting gone some way to assist answering our minute of sometime in February regarding which parts were in the plan and which parts aren't. I'm really just wondering if you will be presenting to us some submissions on, not necessarily today, by way of memorandum perhaps, as to what council resolutions have actually done and whether things have been moved from the plan as I understand the expectation was.
Yes, the submissions that I filed for the hearing do not cover that.
Yes, I realise that. I was really just saying that it would be useful for us to get that officially so that we can respond to it and enable us to comment on it as well.
Yes, that's understood.
If you felt there was a need for us to hear you in person, we could perhaps organise time for that. But that would have to be outside of this hearing, I suspect.
Yes. I understand that I'll be coming back at the start of the urban design guidelines for 2 days.
Right. That might be a suitable time.
I'll speak to Mr. Barr about that.
If I had something in writing and I had any questions that I could ask you, it would probably be a good opportunity.
Yes, that's fine.
Now the second thing I have to do is I have to make a declaration for this hearing stream. I live in Wanaka, and the property I live in is zoned large lot residential. I also point out that the size of the lot is 1,895 square metres, so it is less than the 2,000 that has been proposed by Ms. Leach. I thought it was important to get that on the record.
If that were your question, I'll now turn to the
legal submission. The only other comment was the business stream will end up with the same deferred things. And I really like to not have to do a minute on last day.
You understood that we're going to have that conversation this morning.
Thanks.
Thank you. So, the written legal submission, the introduction, if you'll leave here, I'll just take that as read. It explains the five chapters that are before you for your consideration. These submissions address the scope of this hearing, the council's approach to deferral or transfer of submission points, and the key issues on the residential chapters. In terms of the key issues, there are, in my reading of the evidence, it is largely planning issues that remain in dispute between the council and submitters, and they tend to be focused on more detailed provisions in terms of what is the appropriate height or what is the appropriate recession standard or more detailed planning matters rather than some any strategic challenge to the approach that's been taken through the chapters as a whole. Of course, this is just a hearing on the text, when we come back next year for the rezoning hearing, there could be a slightly different focus, but in the evidence that we have before us, it's largely planning evidence and it has focused on the detailed provisions in the chapter, including some of the objective facilities. As I've mentioned, the summaries of the council's evidence that is before you and you will hear today and tomorrow has responded at a general level to some of the key issues and submitted evidence. And I also asked Ms. Lee to provide in her first evidence summary that she would present, which is the low density zone, a summary of all of the five chapters. And the purpose of doing that was so that the panel had an explanation of all five chapters, and that was provided before we worked through each chapter separately. We do of course have, and I'm sure you've noticed, five section 42A, and they are reasonably lengthy. The reason for that is because of resourcing purposes. Simply wasn't possible for one person to work through all five chapters and put it into one section 42A report. In paragraph 2.4, I refer to and adopt the opening legal submissions that were presented in the first strategic directions hearing in terms of council's functions and statutory obligations and relevant legal considerations. And also whether submissions are on stage one of the proposed district plan. These submissions are not repeated here, but in summary, the Environment Court gave a comprehensive summary of the mandatory requirements in the Long Bay case. Subsequent cases have updated the Long Bay summary following amendments to the RMA in 2005, and the detailed summary of that was attached to our legal submissions presented in the strategic directions hearing. At section 3, I make a note that the Otago Regional Council has issued a public notice stating that decisions have been made on submissions on the proposed regional policy statement for Otago. Following drafting of these three paragraphs, we have received a minute from the panel, and I think what I'm saying here is consistent with your minutes,
yes. Sir.
The only thing to add there is that in the very last line, I referred to council suggests that the council and submitters are also given an opportunity to file legal submissions and possibly planning evidence depending on the outcome of the review of the decision, and that should read in the context of hearing streams 1 to 6, because I'm not sure or aware submitters will come to you this week and next week in a position to talk about the decision, so I wouldn't want to be suggesting that they wouldn't be given that same opportunity.
I think in part two depends on how quickly the Regional Council can identify which parts are affected by appeals and which parts aren't, given that it doesn't close until the middle of November. I doubt that they will close before Christmas.
So that is just raising that the petitions have been issued, but the panel get that to us on Friday.
Yeah.
In section 4, scope of the residential hearing, there are 5 stage 1 residential chapters that are being considered, and the scope of the hearing includes any defined terms used within those chapters. I make note in paragraph 4.2 that the visitor accommodation provisions were withdrawn from the proposed plan in March, and those provisions have been taken out of the revised chapters. They are not in there anymore. And the submissions that were on them, also in the accept reject table, they are noted as being out of scope because there are no provisions for them to be on. At paragraph 4.3.
Before you go on to that, this isn't the first time we've faced submissions that are out of scope because the council has drew things. There are others in the heritage section that have been changed by the area. Would it be better and easier for the hearing panel to understand if the council identified them as separate appendix as out of scope rather than scattering them amongst all the others? I know it's too late for this one, but it then, the way it's phrased, presented to the panel at the moment, the panel's invited to make a recommendation to the council on those submissions, and your submission from the council is we don't need to.
Yes, I think it's entirely sensible.
Mm. And it would be better to be helpful if they went through the previous streams and with those appendices of the scope ones too, so we can make sure that they're not erroneously recommending rejection or acceptance of something that is out of scope.
Yes, they actually could just highlight them or something
like that. Or even put them on a separate table. They're just Excel spreadsheet tables and cut them and move them.
Yeah. Before you go on, can I just signal whether it's here or elsewhere, I'd benefit from an understanding of how the provisions exclude visitor accommodation. Not the decision of the council to say it doesn't want it included. I would like to understand what would happen if someone wanted to propose a VA activity under these provisions, and what would happen.
Yes. So the reason they were withdrawn was that the council decided that they hadn't essentially done enough work because of the housing demand and the key issue down here in terms of housing supply. Visitor accommodation provisions will be notified in stage 2, so they will be coming into the proposed plan, but essentially more work was required before they went to hearing.
You know, I understand all that. What I'm asking is, we don't have the stage 2, and we have to reach our own view on what degree of speculation we indulge to forgive it issue based on them being swept up later.
Yes, so there's no specific rules, so the fallback standard in each of the chapters would presumably apply because they're not listed activity.
So hence my question, does that actually mean they are provided for directly in the provisions under the umbrella of a non-specified activity with an explicit resource management response being put forward?
The objectives and policies have also been withdrawn rather than objectives and policies, but in essence they are provided for as the words you're about to use in terms of they are a default, they go to the default activity stage.
Yeah, well what I'm trying to get to is we end up in a game where no one says VA, but they say for VA, maybe the general default activity status for things that aren't mentioned, including VA, should be activity status X, which would seem to me to be a very elaborate way of talking about VA without saying it's VA. Should it be prohibited, for instance? Should it default to the underlying provisions of the Act that talk about activities not specified in a plan for which consent is required that are outside of the plan? I don't know, but I'm just trying to understand that because it seems to me that although the council has said VA is out of the plan, it seems that it's very clearly in the plan, it's just the council's promoting it, don't actually specify it.
Yes, so
but still have a response that relies on objectors' policies and an activity state. So I'm just saying I actually don't understand how it would work through the mechanics of the plan, so I'm not trying to suggest I've got a criticism of what's happened. I'm asking to be informed.
Yes.
You can probably blame the councillors for that. Because it flipped into the two articles, many debates about visitor accommodation with the proliferation of what Airbnb that I think was decided to chuck it to one side, leave it for the next council and leave it as a problem for the panel here. So at the moment, anything in the VA is capable of undercut what's existing now.
Well, that's another option as well. Does conceivably the adoption of this plan, let's assume it goes the way the council recommendations are, does that mean the current operative plan gets withdrawn in its entirety, except for anything that relates to existing VA provisions that stays alive?
No, Commissioner. This plan has been notified. We've only notified the first stage of the plan. There is a second stage to be notified, and the paper that the Chair referred to earlier is the paper that went to the Council about the content of Stage 2, and that paper also covers matters or parts of the operative district plan that are not going to be notified at all. So, in terms of the chapters that currently form part of the proposed district plan, there's still another stage to be notified.
I understand all that, but you'll appreciate we've all been around the blocks before, and we've all seen councils promise we will do X, and then 10 years later X hasn't happened. And so we're in a position where we're being asked to make decisions on stage one, and I'm not sure about my colleagues, but I'd be pretty nervous just saying, don't worry about it, the mythical stage two is going to take care of any other problem we imagine. I think that's a jurisdictionally pretty shaky ground, don't you think? Just placing faith in something that we have no knowledge of at all.
At this point in time, the council hasn't approved stage two chapters for notification. The paper that went to council was essentially saying this is what council officers are considering for to include in stage two, and the council officers and council cannot preempt what that will be because that is a full council's decision in terms of what is notified. I understand what you're saying exactly, and the council's intention is that the visitor accommodation provisions will be notified in stage two. In terms of people making a submission on those particular provisions that have been withdrawn, they have fallen away, but there are other submissions before you that talk about the importance of providing accommodation for the tourism industry and visitors, etc. And so the theme is still there, it still sits in terms of how things apply, but it's those particular provisions that can
be used.
But I do hear what you're saying, Commissioner.
I think to shortcut it to the conclusion, where I'm struggling a little bit is, notwithstanding the question of scope, how we address a submitter who might say, as they have, and it's been discussed briefly in the 42A report, in the LDRZ anyway, even though it's out of scope, it's still provided for as an unspecified non-complying activity, and I'd like that changed, either by specifying it or by keeping it unspecified by changing the activity status. And it seems to me in that scenario, I'm not seeing how we can just say, no, that's out of scope, go away, because they're talking about a provision in a plan that's up for contestation, the any other non-specified activity rule.
Yes. Well, the recommendations before you are that, I can't recall whether Ms. Lee recommends changing or not changing the
form
for that purpose, but the council's position is that specific rules and activity statements for the visitor accommodation will come in stage two, and that there's no reason to change the fallback status at this time. There's still a question as to the timing of notification of stage two, and I suspect it will be notified before the decisions are made or your recommendations are made on these chapters. from it.
Okay. But notwithstanding the counsel position, I still have the proposition I put to you, which was submitted saying whether we call it V8 or not, there's a rule proposed before us that says effectively it should be non-compliant in all the red zones. We disagree. Do you think, I'm trying to understand with the scope issue, there is a rule in the plan that has a direct but not labelled activity status for V8. Can we actually do anything about it? Where are we minded to?
It depends on the scope to move. I would have to go on a submission, but if the submission is to change the underlying or the default activity status, then there is submission to change it.
As long as we just don't mention, is there accommodation in any provision? That would be then the official scope, isn't it? But what I'm hearing, as long as you just say VA, there's a problem. But as long as you don't say VA, then there's that grey area. I think that's all I'm really trying to understand.
I'd like to read the submission.
Yeah, sure.
I'm sorry.
Sure. No, apologise.
Familiar with that submission.
It's an unusual situation we're in.
Yes, staged plans.
Okay, look, thank you. Sorry to distract you.
No, that's fine. Turning back to paragraph 4.3, I just mentioned there that Arrowtown design guidelines, they have been scheduled for the last 2 days of the residential hearing. I just write there that these legal submissions do not address those guidelines at all with section 42A report, and if evidence hasn't been filed, I think that goes in on Wednesday. Paragraph 4.4, I mentioned this morning the relevant system provisions for the subdivision chapter. Perhaps it's easier if I go straight to paragraph 4.6. Here I list the relevant rule numbers that have been subject to the chair's minute of Friday and his minute of this morning, which confirmed that these provisions and submission points on them have been transferred across into this
area. All of my money, the transfer was the council reporting officer and something transferred them. The only reason I issued the minute in terms of Queenstown Airport is because they said we're called on. They haven't dealt with our submission that could have been transferred.
Yes.
I didn't correct plans, did it? I just said the expectations was that they would do it.
Yes, so following Mr. Bryce's recommendation in the subdivision hearing, which was to transfer out the relevant submission points on the relevant provision from the subdivision chapter.
Yeah.
Yes, so what I have asked for in paragraph 4.6 is confirmation that, and this is for the benefit of submitters, so that they are clear that these four standards are being heard within this hearing. The first one is Rule 27.1, that is the larger table that includes the residential specific standards for minimum lot areas, and perhaps I should be clearer in that it's not the entire table, it is only the minimum lot areas for the residential zone. Rule 27.5.2 and notified Rule 27.5.3, these are specific exceptions to the minimum lot area size, which is set out in the table in 27.5.1.
Rule 27.5.3 refers to submissions of that in the supplemental chapter from Patterson Pitts, very helpful submissions there. And I don't think it would be, unless the submitters think that they are going to be making submissions on it at this point. I don't think there's any point reason why we should reconsider that in this hearing. I know there's a relationship that we could end up with two differently constituted panels coming up with two different ideas.
So my understanding is that Ms. Lee's evidence summary essentially rolls over the recommendations for Mr. Price. No further recommendations are made to that particular standard. The purpose of raising it was so that a consistent approach was taken to 27.
Yes.
Quite true, which is the notified number, and that both of those standards are specific exceptions to residential zones to the minimum lot area set out in the table.
It might be helpful if this leads the submissions from Patterson Fitz from memory were given orally. It might be useful for her to listen to that recording. They made some very useful and helpful suggestions in relation to the actual practicality of using the law that she might find helpful before she. Well, she can do it tonight. Be helpful. Or alternatively, for her reply.
Yes, thank you for that observation. So, turning to paragraph 4.8, I just mentioned there that the consideration of the specific subdivision provisions has required consideration. Of this definition as applied to unit title, strata title and cross-lease subdivisions, and in relation to how the site standards of the proposed plan apply to these subdivision types. This is addressed by Ms. Banks in her summary of evidence for the high density residential zone.
Were you also to, well, I was just going to say that Ms. Banks was the one submission on the definition of site. And checking that submission, all it sought was that the name of the Unit Titles Act be changed from 1972 to 2010. I wonder whether there is scope for what Ms. Banks is suggesting, or whether a variation is required. And the other question, what is a strata title? There's no definition in the plan. No legislation on strata titles. Even though the term is used in the plan, as if it is different from a unit title.
Yes, I'll speak to Ms. Banks during the adjournment about these two questions.
Thank you. Here's a question.
Yeah, thanks. So just on the issue of site, again, it's just a signal of a clarification I'd like from whoever at whenever. When I was reading through the provisions, it wasn't always immediately clear to me whether when a given rule or policy talked about site, it was talking about proposed sites or the underlying site to which an application might be being made. And I'm specifically talking about rules that talk about, you know, how many units per site before rules get triggered. So if I'm proposing five 450-metre sites, does that mean I've got five sites each thrown out, whatever the rules allow, or is it actually trying to capture the, if you like, the parent site? That's not always clear. And I think it would be helpful for everyone to know.
Thank you. We'll come back to you on the next one. Finally, in terms of submissions, the paragraph 4.9, Ms. Banks omitted to consider reporting Mount Crystal's submission relating to height in the high density residential zone, and that has also been addressed in her evidence summary. Paragraph 5, I refer there to earlier submissions that have been given in terms of case law and principles, and I have attached the highlights or the summary in Appendix 1 of these submissions. There's just one issue to bring to your attention, that is the evidence of Mr. N. Greaves on behalf of Mr. David Barton. His the submission of David Barton, requests removal of the 100 square metre or less gross floor area requirement from notified policy 7292. Mr. Green's evidence questions the non-compliant status of notified rule 746 relating to commercial activities, and he suggests the discretionary activity status instead. So Mr. Green's evidence appears to go beyond the submission for the client that he is acting for. I also note just at this point...
Is there any other submission we're seeking the same, seeking the outcome that Mr. Green has suggested?
None that are mentioned in this evidence, sir, or that I understand that they are a further submission on. There may be generally, which of course in terms of the scope of the panel,
yes.
In the view of the panel is...
as an expert, he's fully entitled to evidence on an outcome that might be achieved through someone else's submission, but he's not bound to know his client's position.
Yes, well, we've given quite comprehensive submissions to you on this point. I've raised this just in the context of Mr. Green's evidence, and that does go further. But that is expecting that the panel has got to make a change if there is a separate submission asking for that change.
Yes, well, that's probably more important for us to know. I accept what you say about his own client, but he's not bound by his client's position.
Turning to section 6, here I've set out the strategic overview of the five chapters. With your leave, I'll take paragraph 6.1 as read. I've already covered that with you. Paragraph 6.2. The availability of land for residential use is fundamental to the social, economic and cultural well-being of the people and communities in the Queenstown Lakes District. Due to significant growth in housing affordability issues in the district, providing for increased density residential activities is considered necessary in order to address projected growth and housing demands. However, residential activities have potential for adverse effects on the environment, particularly landscape and amenity values. Appropriate management of land for residential use is therefore important in the promotion of sustainable management of the district. I refer here to the evidence of Mr. Osborne, and he will cover this in his highlight summary, but he talks about, from an economic perspective, the encouraging and facilitation of medium and high density residential development in the district will improve community well-being and the economic viability of the district. He talks about, rather than simply adding to the land available for redevelopment, medium and high density residential options offer significant economic benefits in the district context. Many of the potential costs are already mitigated by the market, while appropriate provisions can be applied to minimise the remaining costs. I think Mr. Osborne's evidence is quite relevant in that context. In paragraph 6.3, the retention of historic heritage is fundamental to the social, economic and cultural well-being of the people and communities in the district. Our buildings in the historic area of Arrowtown are important for its character, and therefore specific controls are necessary to protect the present development and encourage future development to reflect the historic, aesthetic and amenity characteristics of the existing development. In paragraph 6.4 and 6.5, I refer there to part 2 of the RMA. At 6.6, I refer to the urban growth boundaries that the proposed district plan has applied to the urban areas of Queenstown, Arrowtown and Wanaka. All of the residential zones considered with this hearing stream are located within the boundaries of the defined urban growth boundaries.
There is an exception that I'd like to draw to your attention. On map 30, there's an area of low density residential on the east side of Lake Hayes, which is not within the urban growth boundary. I wonder if well, not really a mapping hearing, it seems inconsistent that both your submission and the evidence of Ms. Lee.
Paragraph 6.7, the purposes of the respective zones, the low density to provide for suburban densities and housing forms that are well designed and located to provide a high level of residential amenity. Community activities are also anticipated where residential amenity is not unduly compromised. In the medium density zone, its purpose is to provide for a greater supply of diverse housing options for the district, while still ensuring that housing forms are well designed and located to provide residential amenity. The medium density zone may incorporate small scale commercial activities where these enhance residential amenity or support the town centre and do not undermine the ability of the zone to provide housing supply. Community activities may also be located within the medium density zone. In the high density zones, to provide for more intensive use of land within close proximity to town centres that is easily accessible by public transport, cycle and walkways. The zone is intended to have a key role in minimising urban sprawl and consolidating growth in existing urban areas. In Queenstown, buildings greater than two stories in height are anticipated, and buildings of predominantly two stories are anticipated in Wanaka. The large lot zone serves as a buffer between high density residential areas and rural areas that are located outside urban growth boundaries, and its purpose is to provide a lower density living opportunity. Finally, the Arrowtown Residential Historic Management Zone, its purpose is to provide for a continued sensitive development of the historic area of residential Arrowtown in a way that will protect and enhance those characteristics which make it a valuable part of the town's local residents and visitors. The zone seeks to retain the early subdivision pattern and streetscape and ensure development is sympathetic to the present character. Infill housing is not anticipated in this zone, although there is provision for residential flats to increase the diversity of residential accommodation in the zone. Paragraph 6.8, I mentioned there the relevance of the historic heritage chapter to the Arrowtown Residential Historic Management Zone. The district-wide chapter manages historic heritage features, including the provision of two heritage precincts in Arrowtown, whereas chapter 10, being the underlying zone, provides for the continued sensitive development of the historic area of residential Arrowtown. And I refer there to proposed planning map 28, which shows the relevant precincts and overlays.
Before you move on to the next topic, understand we'll roll through each of the zones and the submissions raised in turn, but I do have some questions of clarification that relate to the overall zone strategy, such as you've just given a highlight package through. What's the best way of dealing with those? Is it at the end of the council presentation or before we've got into individual topics? Or where would they fit in?
Are they legal questions or planning questions?
They're questions such as what is the strategy around the use of activity status? What is the meaning of low density in the low density zone and the large lot zone? Both saying low density, but both talking about totally different outcomes. So it's not as necessarily as simple as saying legal or planning. It's clarification.
Yeah.
I can give it that label. But it's not necessarily confined to just one of the specific zones.
So I've asked Ms. Lee to provide an overview of the five zones.
Okay, good.
Ask those questions of. She is the author of three of the Section 42A. If there are any that she cannot, she may need to defer them to either Ms. Lee.
That's fine. I think the answer was we'll have a chance to look at them as a package before diving into.
Yes, and we'll do that. She'll do that in the first
great
part of the first.
Thank you.
Okay, so turning to the Urban Design Panel, Mr. Garth Bobner has provided evidence on behalf of the Council, Urban Design Evidence. And he has recommended that the use of the urban design panel should be mandatory, or alternatively that use of the urban design panel could be encouraged through non-verification incentives. And this is for the high and medium density zones. The council's position on these issues is set out in the section 42A reports for those two zones. In terms of Mr. Faulkner's recommendation for a trigger in the high density zone, I understand it to be where it's six residential units or more, that would be the trigger. But that hasn't been recommended. The council's hasn't been recommended. The council's position is that the current procedure for use of the urban design panel, which is that it is non-mandatory but encouraged, and recommended for proposals where urban design assessment is required, is adequate and will remain available under the proposed district plan. The council's position is that notification is also best undertaken by considering the relevant sections of the RMA. At paragraph 6.11, the same position is set out that relates to the medium density zone. Mr. Faulkner again recommended that the use of the urban design panel is mandatory for developments in that zone, and I understand that no development or trigger was given as to when it should be required. The council position as set out in the section 42A report is that the objectives, policies and rules as recommended will ensure a good urban design outcome for the proposed medium density zone. It's also noted that as this is a new zone, it will be difficult to estimate the potential number of consent applications to be reviewed by the urban design panel. The council submits that the current urban design panel process is functioning well and should remain voluntary. Urban design guidelines. The council has undertaken to advance guidelines for the high and medium density residential zones through stage two. It is planned to notify these in stage two, and it is probable that these will be incorporated by reference in a similar manner as the Arrowtown Design Guidelines 2016. And I just note there are variations to stage one, two, which may be necessary at that time. However, in the interim, or if these do not eventuate, and the only reason I have those words there is because it's final council approval as to what is notified. Council's view is that the recommended provisions are appropriate to address urban design considerations. And Mr. Faulkner's evidence also indicates that the redrafted objectives and policies of Chapter 8 and the notified objectives and policies of Chapter 9 are appropriate in supporting good design outcomes.
So let's say this panel agrees and recommends adoption of provisions effectively as per the council recommendation. It would seem, based on the evidence before us, we'd have to reach a view on whether or not such guidelines were necessary. We'd have to satisfy ourselves that they weren't. How does the council then justify that they are in stage two on the back of us saying clearly they're not needed in terms of efficiency, effectiveness or other outcomes? Does that mean the council gets new experts to come in saying we got it wrong, or you can appreciate we can't just say it's appropriate. We at 6:14, we have to say what's most appropriate, and if most appropriate is not guidelines, how does the council then come in saying actually they are?
Well, Mr. Faulkner's evidence is that the redraft of the objectives and policies are appropriate in supporting good design outcomes. So his evidence supports the objectives and policies and where the council's got to. He's essentially saying, well, I'd also recommend more. And at this point in time, at this hearing, we don't have design guidelines in front of you. They haven't been formulated, and we can't give them to you and say this is what they look like. So the council's hands are tied essentially in that respect, but they have said that they're going to start drafting them. Fortunately for Arrowtown, they've been drafted and notified in time and intend to be incorporated into this and heard at the same time as this hearing, so you can make recommendations at the same time. Mm-hmm. But because of timing issues, we haven't been able to do that for these two factors.
because at least the tension exists, particularly in the air child situation, of the implication of who God was. And probably the same could be said for the students as well. However, is that within the scope of what we're looking at?
At the moment, we've got Eric and Design Guidelines.
We've got a group that looks at applications for building these organizations and things, and they can tick them or say no. So it's appointed by council, but acts independently of council.
Should we be doing anything to that? The Arrowtown Design Guidelines have been notified as a variation to the Stage 1 chapters, and at this point in time the Council's Section 42A report and evidence hasn't been released, and I'm not in a position to speak to you about that. I'm sorry, but there are 2 days allocated at the end of this hearing which will be focused entirely on those design guidelines and any submissions that have been made on them. That might be the best time to answer that question.
You can see where I'm coming from. It's real guidelines, but it's how you administer the guidelines, and I couldn't see anything in here that suggested how that would be done. Just going back to Commissioner Munro's question. I think the point that Commissioner Munro was making is that on the evidence before us in this hearing's been, if we were to come to the conclusion that the best recommendation we could make and the most appropriate way to deal with urban design issues was through the implementation of the objectives and policies and not of urban design guidelines, where, and the council subsequently decides they are going to produce them, how does that mesh up with the recommendations that we come to?
Yes, I understand the question. With your leave, sir, I can think about that a little bit further and come back to you either tomorrow or an hour later.
Tomorrow is probably not helpful.
Thank you.
Possibly.
And I think it's also probably useful for in the first break or one of the breaks, you just sit down with Mr. Feltner as well and just get him to be crystal clear when he speaks to us whether he sees the guidelines effectively as essential or a nice to have that might make things better but that aren't essential, because I think our ability to have confidence in the recommendations before us is pretty contingent on us understanding exactly what the advice is. And if the advice is in fact you do need guidelines, then that might place the council's position on thin ice.
Turning to page 11, paragraph 16. This section covers matters of discretion. I'm not going to take you through this paragraph by paragraph, but similar to some of the other chapters that have been before you, it has been identified that some of the matters of discretion were notified as essentially as matters, and the council officers have recommended some redrafting of them. I have noticed there is one more set that needs similar attention in one of the chapters, but no doubt that will come up in questions anyway. And the council officers have also reformatted or redrafted the objectives and policies consistent with the court procedural minutes, consistent with the other hearings. Just in paragraph 620 and 621, in the medium density residential chapter, the majority of these changes are simply linked to a submission of the REDI group, and they thought that the matters of discretion be drafted as matters of discretion. In terms of the other changes, this is similar to submissions that have been made to you in the district. District-wide, there was a subdivision hearing. I think it was district-wide hearing. But the amendments are not substantive, and they relate to the clarification. And consistent with those earlier lead submissions, the council's position is that as the proposed changes are of mutual effect, there is no legal or procedural barrier preventing the panel from recommending them, and the council subsequently making the changes under clause 16.2 of Schedule 1 of the RMA. On the following page, the matter of discretion relating to natural hazards. This is also a flow-on from the district-wide hearing, and I've copied in paragraph 6.23 the notified matter of discretion. And we discussed the issues with the matter of discretion in that earlier hearing, and there was some acknowledgement that it essentially includes a standard and possibly an assessment matter in the last two lines. In the district-wide hearing, there was scope to remove the matter of discretion, and that was Mr. Barr's recommendation and his right of reply. There aren't any submissions in this hearing requesting that this be deleted. But as this matter of discretion does sit over some other chapters, the council officers are very close to having a version that they're comfortable with across the chapters, and unfortunately didn't have it in time to put in these submissions, but that is progressing. And I'll put this in there to update you on where we were at. So there is acknowledgement that that wording does work, that is accepted by the council.
I take it that the council does consider that as a matter of discretion natural hazards should be considered. Is it really a matter of there being a standard of as to the nature or type of report required?
Yes.
And whether there's scope to include such a standard as well?
Yes, that is correct.
Although potentially I would have thought the regional council's submission on the natural hazards chapter might provide scope.
Well, it does ask for new rules.
Yes.
And it does ask for an entire new rule framework, so yes. And the regional council's recent decision, the council officers have also been looking at that in the process as well. So if you have any questions on for the planners on that matter of discretion, that is some context for
that. When would we expect to see some advice from the planners on that?
I don't anticipate it to be during the course of our opening, but we would like to get something to you. We don't want to wait until the reply. So I will speak to the council officers and I can update.
Right. Okay. Well, we have a week free next week.
Okay.
So the week after that might be when we're sitting again in Queenstown, might be the appropriate time.
Okay.
And we have some spare time in that week on the first 2 days, we could actually set aside time to hear from the council officers specifically on that.
Thank you, sir. On page 13, again, this is an explanation as to some uncertainties in the notified chapter. This is also a follow-on from some of the earlier hearings. In the subheading, clarification of the chapter, the heading is other provisions and rules, and then there is a subheading which is clarification. There have been some questions from commissioners as to the status of these rules, as to whether they are in fact rules or advice notes, that uncertainty is understood. So to provide more certainty as to the status of these provisions, the council suggests that these clarification provisions to be further reordered under additional subheadings, general rules and advice notes. So that is essentially reordering those advice notes so that they are more logical and completely understood what they in fact are.
Are general rules or explanatory rules? In most cases they explain how the subsequent tables are to be considered.
Yes, they do.
I don't mind what the heading is, but I understand and it's consistent with my thinking that they be separated it that way.
Yes. I understand, and I think that's probably the actual recommendation that the planners might want to give their view on this as well.
Mm. I think that would be the appropriate title to call the context of what it is. And then, in my view, we could make that consistent through the other chapters as well.
Yes, and I do know that down in the written submission that this needs to be a consistent change across the plan. And also in paragraph 6.30, I do note that Ms. Leith in her section 42A report for the large lot zone has recommended that some of the clarification notes are in fact unnecessary. They endeavour to provide requirements as to what information needs to be provided with the building consent application, and an RMA planning document is not the appropriate place.
Was it 4.6.2 cover such necessary wounds?
Yes. So I guess the point here is that the officers have endeavoured to tidy up these things for you and make recommendations from them so that hopefully we don't have to work through all that in questioning. That they've endeavoured to create that that for you.
Thank you.
So that accepts for listing the council's witnesses. Takes me to the end of the, my legal submission. Happy to answer any questions from you. What we propose to do is call for expert witnesses first, followed by Ms. Leith to give her, first of all, a summary of the five chapters and answer any questions that cross over those chapters that she can. And then work through the chapters. I have split Ms. Leith up so she has some rest time in between.
Any other questions? Questions on the room? Other than that.
I think that specifically in terms of legal things, I am still, and I think the word is floundering a bit at this jurisdiction and scope issue of the BA, and I would ask you if you could reflect on and give some specific commentary, not now but at the right time, addressing the following direct propositions to you. First, if the provisions, objectives, policies and rules of any or all of the residential zones directly enable a land use consent application to be made for an activity, whether that activity is explicitly named or not, do those provisions provide scope for submissions on those activities? Or in the alternative, if visitor accommodation is to be explicitly not provided for through these planning provisions, does it necessarily lead to a prohibited activity status where no resource consent can be applied for? And I hope that's not too long-winded, but it's trying to get to the nub of it for me. If at the end of the day the provisions mean I can apply for consent, then I think there's an argument that those provisions do allow me to make a submission to talk about the nature of that consent, whether or not there's a perhaps rehearing argument of what we label it, or whether it's labelled or whatever. Maybe I'm oversimplifying it, but that's a point that I'm just in my mind not at all clear on.
I'm the chief engineer here at the Sound Lake District Council. Before I go a little bit further, I wanted to alert you. I would like to make one change in my evidence. If you could go to page number 4, paragraph 1.9. It should read, my evidence will address, and then in addition, the capacity and the infrastructure network to accommodate the additional growth proposed through the notified proposed district plan. And then it proceeds with the wording infrastructure questions raised by submitters in relation to the low, medium, and high density residential chapters and the large lodge residential chapter to the proposed district plan. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, Commissioner. Yeah, I have around about 28 years experience in civil engineering. I'm a member of IPENS, IPWEA, and Board in New Zealand, and a chartered professional engineer here in New Zealand. I'm now for a little bit over 10 years here in New Zealand, was working before Queensland Lakes District Council in the Bay of Plenty for around about 2 years for a consultant called Stuttlebox & King, afterwards for 5 years on the day for Western Bay of Plenty District Council, and was involved in hearing processes out there as well on mainly the Makatu wastewater scheme. On my summary, a key finding from my evidence is that there is capacity in the infrastructure network to accommodate additional growth proposed through the modified residential zone. The long-term plan 2015-25 and the annual plan 16-17 are already covering major upgrades and renewals to cater for increased density. Additional upgrades will be addressed through a long-term plan for an annual plan review process. In general, increased demand from new developments on infrastructure will largely be paid for by the developer. All new assets could be vested into council. Specifically in the low-density residential zone, I have addressed concerns raised from submitters around the wastewater network in Kelvin Heights and the stormwater network in Arrowtown, although computer models identify that there is general capacity across the network for the development anticipated by the proposed district plan. Additional upgrades to services are identified within the current long-term plan for Kelvin Heights. The increased density in Arrowtown may have an effect on the stormwater runoff, which could trigger upgrades on the existing infrastructure. In the medium density residential zone, submitter raised similar concerns around the stormwater network in Arrowtown as in the low density residential zone, specifically if road design changes to more curb and channels. The effects are similar and may result in upgrades of paths. In regards to questions around stormwater treatment, storage and disposal, council supports sustainable urban design principles to minimize effects on the natural environment. In the high density residential zone, impacts on the water and wastewater network are similar as for the low density residential zone and medium density residential zone. There should not be a material increase in stormwater runoff compared to the status quo. The large lot residential zone is located with the urban growth boundaries in Wanaka. Most of the large lot residential zone sites in Wanaka can be serviced with water supply and wastewater. Some of them need to be serviced with an on-site wastewater pump station in relation to the topography. Stormwater treatment and runoff should be addressed through low impact design. This needs to be addressed case by case, depending on ground condition and permeability for soakage. If soakage is not viable, upgrades to the stormwater network will be necessary. In general, for the anticipated developments enabled by the modified proposed district plan, the impact on the existing infrastructure is only minor based on current reviewed and calibrated models. Further, council have identified in the long-term plan a program for renewals, upgrades, and network extensions. Unforeseen events will be addressed through the annual plan and long-term plan process.
Thank you. Well, thank you for that. The provision and maintenance regime for services you've described, including the LTP and annual plans, that seems to me that it allows a lot of regular reviewing and fine tuning of the network. Is that a fair summary?
That's a fair summary, yes.
Appreciating your view that the planned revisions as recommended to us could be managed through the mechanisms you've outlined, how much sensitivity to your confidence in the council's infrastructure management regime is there to the capacity of theoretical dwellings and development that the council's provisions enable? And what I mean by that is, if we were to agree with some of the submissions wanting more density, does that suddenly mean the whole thing falls over, or do you think the council can manage pretty much whatever? Something between those two is probably where the fruit is.
Fair questions, Commissioner Munro. We have just reviewed all our wastewater and water models, mainly related to these infrastructure topics. For example, what's happening at the moment on the water side, we are requiring from a design perspective that all the development and the infrastructure is designed by roundabout, from a water perspective, 700 liters per person per day for a household, with roundabout 3 people per household. So you have roundabout 2,100 liters from a design perspective available, and to design your network around it, from a source to the storage into the recirculation, plus an additional peaking factor depending on the size of the community. What we've done over the last year and a half, we went through water metering trial, and we have put out water meters throughout the district. And the results are based on an account of around about 604 meters we had in Arrowtown, in Kawiyala, Lake Hayes, Luckett, other Wakatipu areas, Queenstown, Shota Country, and Wanaka, is around about 1,100 liters per household per day. So you see already we have a lot of capacity out of these numbers available from the source through the storage and in the recirculation itself. This is in relation to the water supply. And when I brought some, it's pretty hard for you to see. We have done, for example, on the Wanaka side, we have done water models just calibrated based on the current situation. And this is up to year 2025, where you see some issues with the red dots around the township, but this includes the current situation with the current infrastructure in place. For Wanaka, for example, we are looking for a new bore field to provide a better service than for the community, which will address this one. And we have done a similar one for year 2055, done for Queenstown as well. On the wastewater side, it looks similar because similar numbers are used for wastewater designs. We have, in part, issues in regards of inflow and infiltration into the network. We have identified this one throughout the calibration time on the model where we have installed inflow meters into the wastewater network to get a better understanding from a catchment perspective where we have issues after heavy rainfall event in regards of stormwater entering the wastewater system, which will be addressed over the next year, so we will achieve more capacity in the network for wastewater recirculation system and for the pump stations as well.
Okay, well, thanks for that. And to summarise what you said, I haven't heard anything that could, let's just say if we were to not support some of the submissions that want more density, so if we were to say no to those, we wouldn't be saying no because there was no way there could be an infrastructure solution, or there's a critical defect that says we can't have more than 10 extra houses in Lyot or whatever. Is that a fair summary of what you're saying? There are challenges, but at this point you're looking ahead, you're working to address them.
It's definitely a fair summary in regards
okay.
to wastewater and water transportation.
Yes, no, that's fine. Okay, thank you for that. So one of the matters that's been addressed in the Planet report is a policy that talks about encouraging the use of on-site water tanks and those softer, low-impact type techniques. Do they make a material difference in your view on infrastructure capacity and general infrastructure issues?
My personal view is no.
Right.
Maybe on stormwater, but not really a big impact on the.
Okay, so from your perspective, there's no pressing need for us to, for instance, look at promoting or requiring the use of those kind of on-site techniques with residential development in the district.
I agree, Commissioner. I've heard several papers around it on various conferences who have done studies around it and the impact on the network itself and the cost-benefit ratio out of it. That would stay
right
at this point.
Okay, well, thank you. That's helpful. That's all the questions I had for you.
Yeah, just follow up on that one, particularly with regards to stormwater. Council supports urban design principles to minimise effects on the natural environment. How far would you see the plan promoting this, given that some subdivisions are open to stormwater management? They've got a low-lying area as part of another subdivision on the hillside is going to be a lot more of a problem. How stringent do you think a district should be in chasing those?
I
think, very stringent. I think it's important to protect our waterways as well from a pre-treatment perspective, low impact design, so not putting a stormwater pipe directly into a river or in the lake. For example, the lake is mainly our water source for Queenstown and for Wanaka, Lake Wakaskum and Lake Wanaka. I'm fully supportive in this. We are experiencing at the moment, and we are in the startup phase to understand much better the impact on these low impact designs, provisions, as well from a long term perspective, how they operate, how they have to be managed. So our guidance to the developers at the moment is mainly, we are supporting, we help you, you have to manage it for around about 5 years. We are putting KPIs in place to get an understanding how you maintain and operate it over this period based on what the community can expect after you have finished your maintenance and operational period and handed over into council, that there is not a big gap. They have a high standard for maintenance and we have only a low, and this will directly have an impact on the people who are living in this area. So we are learning at the moment in regards of low impact design. I think we have it the first time in our land and subdivision code as part of a requirement.
Just in your discussion of the water issue, did the testing with the metering disclose differences in water use between large sites and small sites?
Yes, yes, dramatically. When you compare the numbers and you look at what's happening, for example, Lake Hayes, they had alone an average of 1,394 compared to Queenstown was sitting on 967 liters per household and Arrowtown on 659. So if, and Lake Hayes, they have all big farms, all about irrigation out there, and this needs to be addressed in the future.
So from an engineering and infrastructure point of view, would it be, from your point of view, advantageous to encourage smaller sites in the district?
The smaller sites helps definitely to reduce the water demand because less irrigation. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and Commissioner.
Thank you. We'll now turn to Dr. Tart.
My evidence in these chapters is of a relatively narrow point around standard insulation. Reading from my summary statement. Residential zones receive sound from a range of sources. The significant sound sources, such as land and air transport, which cannot practically internalise their sound emissions, there can be adverse effects on residential amenity and sleep disturbance causing corresponding health effects. These effects are already widespread, but for new and altered buildings, there is an opportunity to avoid compounding this legacy issue and progressively make improvements. It is common for district plans to include land use controls that require buildings for sensitive activity, that are locating in areas significantly affected by air and land transport sounds, to be designed to result in reasonable internal sound levels. While this is not a perfect solution, if there remain issues of external amenity, in my opinion, it is an appropriate method that allows broader planning issues to be taken into account, as opposed to simply prohibiting houses from large areas around the infrastructure. I consider that criteria for land use control should be taken from New Zealand standards, NZS 605 for airports and NZS 606 for roads. The New Zealand Building Code does not currently address this issue. The rules in the notified versions of chapters 7 and 8 included land use controls for buildings in the low and medium density residential zones affected by airport and road traffic sounds respectively. These acoustic treatment controls include sound insulation and ventilation requirements so that windows can be kept closed to reduce sound entering buildings. A case study by the New Zealand Transport Agency showed the cost of such treatment to be in the order of $10,000 extra on the cost of a new build three-bedroom house. The controls proposed for airport sounds in the low-density residential zone are generally in accordance with New Zealand Standard 6805 and Plan Change 35 to the opposite district plan. I consider these controls to be appropriate to protect internal residential amenities. The notified controls proposed for road traffic sounds are limited to a specific area in the medium-density residential zone. The New Zealand Transport Agency submitted for the controls to be amended and extended across other residential areas. In accordance with New Zealand Standard 6806, I recommend that controls in residential zones should reduce road traffic sounds inside urinals of buildings containing noise sensitive activities so to no more than 40 decibels. Such controls should be required for a significant distance from many state highways in the district. However, the Transport Agency submission only sought for controls to be applied within 80 metres of state highway, which targets the most affected area. I consider this distance to be appropriate, except the three discrete areas where a shorter distance would be adequate, as five might list out three sections of state highway. Paragraph 7. The General Trust and FII Holdings also sought for acoustic treatment to be required for noise-sensitive activities in the Frankston medium-density residential zone to mitigate sound from existing commercial and industrial sites. These acoustic treatment requirements would likely overlap with controls for road traffic sounds. But regardless of this overlap, I consider that commercial and industrial activities should be required to comply with the receiving zone noise limits from Chapter 36. So acoustic treatment to buildings in the medium density residential zone should not be needed for that purpose. An exception is that acoustic treatment might be appropriate for buildings in the medium density residential zone near the designated Transpower Frankston substation, but further information about the transformer sound levels would be needed to determine appropriate extent of controls if they were to be applied. Thank you.
Thank you. In the context of the ASANs and OCBs and the previous plan changes 35 and before that 19 is mentioned in some of the evidence, which rightly or wrongly I have some involvement in just to record that as well as a commissioner. So what I haven't quite got my head around is the relationship between the ability to mitigate acoustic effects through insulation, mechanical insulation, etc., etc., and the density of persons per hectare that might be appropriate. And one of the questions before us is whether development should be limited to one unit per 450 square metres, still subject to acoustic insulation. And so at a really basic level, one has to ask the question, either the internal living environment can be made appropriately safe or it can't. And if it can, why would one stop at one unit per 450 square metres? Or if it can't, why would we allow those one house per 450 square metres to live in unsafe noise environments? So I guess that's one of the things I'm not quite clear about, is how the density limit relates to the ability to actually deal with the fundamental. You understand what I'm asking?
So there was a number of points in there. That there was a very fine question is, can we deal with the internal effects, yes or no? The answer is yes. So we can insulate the house so that people can sleep so they don't get sleep disturbance effects and corresponding health effects. There are wider issues coming into play associated with annoyance and external amenity. The justification for land use controls is often framed around a reverse sensitivity on the airport, but if too many people complain, they won't be allowed to extend their operations or change their operations as they'd like to, or as the market sort of demands. So the 450 square metre discussions, if you allow more people to build more houses within the airport noise consoles, those people will still be able to sleep. But you may have more people who are annoyed by aircraft noise in the consoles because of their external amenity, and because they might not like the fact they have to keep their windows closed to sleep. So those annoyance effects could then have a reverse sensitivity effect on the airport.
Appreciating you're an acoustic expert generally, not limited just to airports or what have you. But are you aware of any airports in New Zealand that have had their operations curtailed through reverse sensitivity effects and complaints of neighbours?
So I'm aware of airports in New Zealand that have had their operations curtailed. Queenstown Airport wants to operate night flights, they've had that curtailed. The extent to which that is a result of reverse sensitivity, it's very difficult to determine, because there's a long-standing process of when the airport was built and when the houses around it developed and when. So certainly sensitivity and annoyance to aircraft noise has curtailed airport operations at least Queenstown, and I'm sure there'll be other airports and ports and infrastructure in New Zealand where that occurs. Whether you can finger it just on the fact there was a new house and therefore it's definitely a reverse sensitivity rather than a general community sensitivity to noise, it would be very difficult to break out. My friend got most experience with road noise, and there's lots of examples where reverse sensitivity has impacted on sort of roading projects where a new subdivision has been built and then it's impacted on the ability to construct a new So it's a real effect.
So, as I understand what you said, it's that the fundamental health and safety aspect of residents' well-being can be addressed by way of design, insulation, etc. There's a residual, let's call it nuisance, issue of people objecting to noise and complaining about it. That seems to be what I'm taking from what you're saying.
So I suppose to be pedantic, you use the word well-being in a noise point of view. So the health issue of the sleep disturbance actually addressed in the broader well-being, that the extent to which you can enjoy your outdoor
is
sort of consequence of that. So broader well-being and amenity cannot be addressed through the acoustic insulation.
No, people might not like noise, I understand that. I'm aware of an example in my hometown where a scarce land resource was being promoted to accommodate simultaneously lots of living in a major stadium. And the plan in that instance, instead of limiting the density, required all new developments to be subject to various no complaints requirements to take out of play their ability to raise complaints and objections, to give confidence to the major infrastructure operator that they wouldn't be curtailed. Are you familiar with that kind of technique or method?
Yes, in terms of noise effects, it's a nonsense. There's a small element which is legitimate in the fact that it will serve as a warning to people moving into an area, and people who are particularly sensitive might struggle to collect and not move into the area, so there's a legitimate thing there. In terms of once people are in an area telling them they can't complain about something, it doesn't stop them being affected by it. So it doesn't address the noise effect. In terms of those broader political issues, it may have some bearing, but it doesn't stop sleep disturbance, it doesn't stop annoyance, it doesn't stop those sort of well-being issues.
No, you've told me that insulation and other techniques can take care of the sleep disturbance.
Yes.
And as I understand it, you haven't disagreed that legal and civil requirements can be imposed that take away the ability of objectors to curtail the operator of an adjacent facility. Or they might still receive complaints, but they can have confidence that there's no ability to stop. What seems to be in the middle is the remnants. It's just not a nice environment to be in outside, if it's very noisy and people might not feel too happy about it.
So in terms of the, if there's a legal question about whether no complaints covers from the environment, that's clearly one a question from council. I personally, I've got experience from the transfer agency where they have put such a clause in. Someone's complained regardless, and as a public body, the transfer agency still has to take complaints seriously because it's got to be social and environmentally responsible. So the no complaints part covers, from a technical point of view, they don't deal with the noise effect. I think that, and I've seen practical instances where actually that's a limited purpose anyway. You can't suppress that if there's an issue in the community. It's difficult to suppress that through sort of legal mechanism.
Yeah, I certainly understand how maybe nothing to address the actual noise effect, but I'm very interested in your comment that even when they've been in place for various reasons, operators still maybe have to go through a process of addressing them anyway.
Yeah, I don't know with a private airport company whether they'd be more hard-nosed about it, but certainly for a public body that's got a mandate to be socially responsible, that's a very difficult position to be in.
Okay. Look, thank you for that. That's very informative. Is there something else really?
I'll take the whole adjournment before we continue with questions. And we'll return to that.
I'm sorry, we're ready with the 80 metres.
Yes.
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 Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes.